Howard is going to be doing his talk, Team Human, Can You Live a Life, a Socialist Life in Capitalism? Over to you, Howard.
Thanks very much, Bill. Just to repeat, you should have a sheet of paper in front of you, which is actually a list of the quotations which I'll be referring to in this talk. It's just to make it easy for you to take in what the quotations say. This session is it's billed as being 2 hours long. I hope it won't be as long as that. And to assist in that, I can tell you that the talk, well, once half an hour's passed, there's not much after that. So bear that in mind. All right. Okay. The title of the talk, Team Human, Can You Live a Socialist Life in Capitalism? I'll begin by explaining this reference to Team Human in the title of the talk. It's actually the title of a book published recently, very recently in fact, this year, by the American writer Douglas Rushkoff. And it's a book that calls upon wide-ranging research on human evolution, anthropology and psychology to argue that human beings are essentially social creatures and that we achieve our aspirations best when we work together, not as individuals. As the writer puts it, and this is the first quotation on your sheet, when we work together, we realise greater happiness, productivity and peace. He goes on to argue that the trouble is that today's society is what he calls a vast anti-human infrastructure. And this, he says, undermines our ability to connect with one another. Central to this, he tells us, is money, which he describes as an instrument of exploitation and alienation. Now, clearly there's nothing in this analysis that socialists could object to, absolutely nothing. And virtually every page of this book contains statements to which we would say, yes, yes, yes. A couple of examples, and this is number three. We humans are all part of the same collective nervous system. Number four, capitalism's vision of the individual as a self-interested being whose survival was a Darwinian battle royal is at odds with our social evolution and our neurobiology. And the next one, number five, money, debt, jobs, slavery, countries, race, corporatism, stock markets, brands, religions, governments and taxes are all human inventions. And this is good because it pushes back against the capitalist wisdom that individualises and atomises social phenomena, that tells us that in order to change things, basically we've got to change ourselves, or rather that we've got to take individual action rather than collective action. So, yes, all this is great, but perhaps disappointingly, despite providing a couple of hundred pages of mainly penetrating and cogent analysis, Rushkoff, it's clear he's not a socialist, at least not in our sense of the term. What he does, as so many do, is to fall short, as I would see, in his solution. He doesn't have the socialist solution of a world society of free access brought about by the democratic action of the majority of the world's people. And the actions or solutions he does suggest, although they're laid out with considerable eloquence, clearly wouldn't tackle at their root the problems that capitalism inevitably throws up. And I'm saying that his solutions, laudable though they are in many ways, I'm saying they wouldn't tackle the problems at their root because, for example, he's a fan of cooperatives, of permaculture, of such abstractions as, and this is number six on the handout, reclaiming terra firma and common ideals. And he sort of fades out towards the end by saying, for example, this is number seven, things look bleak, but the future is open and up for invention. Step up and be part of a great project. And by endorsing the need to do this, this need to step up and be part of a great project. He doesn't sort of get round to saying what this great project might be. And whatever it is, unfortunately, there's no obvious sign that it's socialism in our terms. However, what this book does, by its title and by virtually everything else in it, is to reiterate from a wide range of areas of knowledge, and as I've said very eloquently, something that socialists have been arguing for well over a century. That is that human beings are essentially at their happiest, at their most productive when they cooperate, when they work together. Brilliant backdrop here, which this isn't ours, but it fits in perfectly. When human beings work together, they're inclusive and diverse, supportive, collaborative. Fits in perfectly. That's the sort of ethos of this college, Faircroft College. But of course, within the capitalist system, it can only go so far, and very often it sort of ends up more as words than as anything more substantial. And anyway, this book argues, too, that capitalism, with all the features in it that encourage non-cooperative, self-interested behaviour, does what an old comrade in my SPGB branch in Swansea used to call bringing out the worst in people. Yet we all have to continue to live in capitalism, and perhaps for a long time yet. There was some discussion about this last night, wasn't there, when Edmund, the speaker, was suggesting it would take millennia, which I didn't agree with. It might not, but the fact is that the rate of change within capitalism is so rapid that who knows whether, you know, the rate of change towards socialism can't be more rapid than we think. Will it be in our lifetime, won't it? We don't really know. But hopefully it won't take millennia. But in the meantime, we've got to continue to live in capitalism. So how the hell do we stay human in a society that constantly tends to undermine our capacity to work together and to connect with one another? The undermining of our natural empathy, the competitiveness stimulated and often demanded by, for example, the employment system, nationalism and money, are strong forces pushing us in the opposite direction. Yet the fact is that so many people, so much of the time, still engage in activities where they cooperate and work together, and which usually go unreported because they're not news, they're not recorded in the history books. But they are a powerful indication of the inbuilt potential, tendency, call it what you like, that I've been referring to. So people, we, in our everyday lives, engage in countless small acts of cooperation and empathy. So common and so frequent that they usually get taken for granted, and many of them aren't necessarily regarded in that way. Examples of this might be giving priority to other drivers in traffic situations when it might well inconvenience us, standing patiently in queues rather than trying to sort of push in, giving up seats on public transport, and a thousand other small everyday actions and gestures. A recent study by two American behavioural scientists commissioned by the BBC was entitled "The Surprising Benefits of Talking to Strangers." And it said, and this is number 9 on your sheet, "Our research suggests we may underestimate the positive impact of connecting with others for both our own and others' well-being." And it went on, number 10, "Humans are inherently social animals who are made happier and healthier when connected to others." But in addition to these everyday connections, that or almost automatic connections that people make with one another, many people also deliberately and purposefully engage in communal activities. For example, many people belong to societies or clubs in which they share interests with like-minded people. They take part in community groups who are involved in improving the local area or environment. They volunteer to help others in charity and other work, or in organisations like Citizens Advice or trade unions, or even, as people have raised earlier, church groups. Although we're in no sense a religious organisation, we have to recognise that happens. People often do it voluntarily and associatively. And of course, socialists are likely to do these kinds of things as well. Many of us belong to local clubs and community groups, engage in sports with others locally, or are active in trade unions. And it would definitely be churlish to object that in doing these things, we're using time and energy that really should be used to spreading socialist ideas. I say this because life definitely takes on more meaning when it's associative, when it's communal, and when it's varied as well. Now, of course, some socialists do choose, in the spare time available to them, to focus pretty exclusively on activity associated with socialism and with, you know, the Socialist Party of Great Britain. And it's good that they do, actually. But some, at least, may find that a bit one-dimensional and may be happier using some of their spare time participating in activities shared with non-socialists, including, of course, members of their own family. And I'm sort of getting now to talk about can you live a socialist life in capitalism? I'm sort of hopefully getting to the heart of that. So let's, as they say, push the envelope a little bit and ask how do socialists, or how should they, react not just to working with others in small everyday activities, but being asked to go further and be associated with campaigns which involve, for example, lobbying governments to improve conditions in particular areas, signing petitions, calling on political parties to support changes in the law, being members of or giving money to charities which are dedicated to remedying deficiencies in social provision, housing, healthcare, that kind of thing, or being involved in charities, giving money to charities, for example, which are dedicated to saving people from the consequences of sudden disasters, which happen not infrequently, sometimes natural, sometimes man-made. We all receive or see, more or less on a daily basis, appeals for these things on social media, in the press, on television, etc. And we're also called upon with, I think, increasing frequency by campaigns or organisations to offer support for more humane policies on things like benefits, employment rights, immigration, environment, and much else. This applies both to us as individuals and to the SPGB as a party. Now, of course, much of this, I don't have to tell most of you, amounts to our being called upon to support reforms of the current system rather than working to get rid of it. And this can be tricky ground because it's clear, it's fundamental, that the Socialist Party does not support the sticking plaster activity of reforms. The socialist view is that time spent in attempts to reform capitalism is essentially time wasted. And if I can briefly elaborate on this for people here who may not be fully acquainted with the Socialist Party's position on reformism, our opposition to reformism isn't that it doesn't sometimes benefit people, workers, but rather that it distracts from the real source of the problem, that source being the capitalist system of buying and selling and production for profit. Socialists regard reformism as a sort of fixation on complaints about the day-to-day running of the capitalist system, a system that constantly throws up the need for reforms. As soon as you think you've sort of solved one issue, another one arises. And if we were to engage with these, it would take up a massive amount of our time and energy without getting us any closer to our goal. So reform activity can only at best modify the system slightly, tinker at its edges rather than get rid of it. But at the same time, it would distract from the fundamental task of changing the system root and branch. A prime practical example of the futility of reformism is provided by a truly excellent article, I think, anyway, in last month's Socialist Standard on homelessness, the obscenity of homelessness. Some of you will no doubt have read this. It shows how all attempts to solve the problems of homelessness over a long period, while these may help a small number of people, fail most of them. And it shows how these attempts are as likely to result in reforms having to be reformed over and over again with little evidence of improvement or success. So reforms don't have the effect of allowing capitalism to be run in the interest of the majority, the workers, any more, as we often say, than an abattoir can be run in the interest of the cattle. You can make conditions a little bit better, maybe, but in the end, the cattle are still going to be slaughtered. And so these ever-recurring problems are rooted in the system itself. You've got to change the vehicle, not the driver, in other words. But having said all of this, on a human day-to-day level, individual socialists do often find it difficult just to stand by and do nothing, especially when things come along that seem to be especially urgent or emergencies, things which involve connecting with other humans, are difficult to ignore. So while being aware that getting involved in them could suck you up into reformist activity, into becoming involved in trying to patch up the system, we nevertheless have to sort of reflect on what action we should take, if any. So how do we cope with the constant dilemmas thrown up by wanting to spend our time helping to create a different, a truly associative social system, socialism, yet constantly being called upon to help patch up arrangements which are contrary to this? In other words, how can a socialist conduct the best socialist life possible on a day-to-day basis while not yielding to the pressures to effectively support the reformist activity of capitalism, which as socialists we should have no truck with for the reasons I've outlined? Well, I've referred to the to urgent issues or emergencies that arise all the time within capitalism. So what I'm going to do is take a few examples of these in terms of their impact on my own personal experience as a way of trying to make things a bit less abstract and to shed some light on what a socialist life might be in capitalism. Now, I know there are some risks in my trying to do this. One risk is to appear to be engaging in what nowadays people call virtue signalling. Sorry if some of it may appear like that. Another risk is being considered in one way or another to be flying in the face of the party's principles with regard to reformism. But never mind, I'll try anyway. Right, so I said I was going to give some examples. First example, when I was first thinking about this talk, I received an email from someone called Jean-Pierre Barois. He's French. I don't know him personally, but I've had messages from him many times for the campaigns he conducts, all of which might broadly be called humanitarian. This particular message was headed, and that's number 11 on your sheet, "Please endorse urgent appeal for the immediate release of all political prisoners in Algeria." He was asking people to sign a petition calling for the release of political activists, lawyers, young people and trade unionists in Algeria. For example, there were people like Haj Germoul, a young activist of the Algerian League for the Defence of Human Rights and a member of the National Committee of the organisation. In February, Haj Germoul had held up a sign in opposition to the Algerian President Bouteflika's campaign for a fifth term in office. The sign read, "No to a fifth term." For that, he was sentenced to 6 months in prison. Another of the people Barois was campaigning for was Louise Hanoun, General Secretary of the Workers' Party in Algeria, who'd been arrested on the 9th of May and charged with conspiracy against the state authority and the military authority. So this was a petition I was being asked to sign. I didn't sign it, so that's the first example. come back to that later, perhaps. Second example, in May, I received an email from a party member asking me to sign a petition to stop the extradition of Julian Assange. I did sign that petition. Okay, third example, some time ago I received an email message from a campaigning organisation, I think it was 38 Degrees. It asked me to write to my MP to protest regarding revelations that HSBC had been helping the super rich dodge their taxes and that the government had not been acting to stop this. And more recently, I got another one from the same organisation asking me to write a letter in support of a campaign to bring down NHS waiting times. I didn't write either of these letters. Fourth example, I'm asked not infrequently to sign local petitions by people from the local community centre where I'm on the committee and I also play for an indoor bowls team. These are usually petitions associated with things like unwanted local developments in the area or the spread of houses in multiple occupation. I nearly always do sign these. Fifth example, last month I received an email message from an organisation many of you may know called AVAS, and it was entitled, and this is number 12 on your sheet, Amazon Apocalypse, and it read, "It's horrifying. Half a billion trees have been lost in the Amazon in the past year. Right now, Amazon champions in Brazil's Congress are considering sweeping new protections, and indigenous groups are calling for international pressure to help save the forest. Let's build a massive show of citizen support and stand up for the Amazon. Sign now." This petition was an appeal to the recently elected president of Brazil, Bolsonaro. It was expressed very passionately, and I did give it thought, but in the end I didn't sign. Sixth example, I've nearly come to the end of them now. Like many other people, I'm rained on with appeals on the web or in the post to sign petitions or give money to support multiple causes. In my case, many of them animal ones. Donkeys, cats, dogs, gorillas, elephants. There's a website, for instance, called Lady Freethinker, some of you may know, which specialises in exposing and trying to stop cruelty to animals. A recent one of their appeals was about Korea's annual dog-eating festival, where thousands of dogs are, in the words of their message, hanged, beaten and burned alive. I do give small amounts to a few of these appeals, and I sometimes sign the petitions. In this last case of the dog-eating festival, I did sign. Right, seventh and last example, I voluntarily give a small regular donation to the following charities, having been approached by them to do so at some time in the past. Bolino Animal Sanctuary, Oxfam, Cats Protection, Red Cross, Dogs Trust. I should also probably say that I have a monthly standing order to the Socialist Party Great Britain over and above my branch contributions. So how coherent or incoherent is all that? I might say search me, but actually I do think there's a bit of coherence to it that may reflect the concerns I hope people might have in a socialist world. And it also makes me feel that I'm trying to live a socialist life to the extent that it's possible to do so in a capitalist world. How? Well, to explain, I shy away from what you might call the overtly political things like appeals to governments or political parties to improve conditions within capitalism. However, like the party generally, I won't necessarily be opposed to particular improvements that might be brought in, to particular reforms, even if I know that the most likely reason for them is that they will allow the profit system to operate more efficiently and also in the knowledge that they can be pretty easily withdrawn in the future if it's considered they're not working to benefit the profit system. So I focus on less obviously political matters, usually involving people or animals, and take the view that being involved in these matters is more personal than political. And if I seem to endorse a charity advocating what some people may see as a reform by donating to it, The way I see it is that I'm not doing that in a, as an expression of my membership of or adherence to the Socialist Party. Again, at a very personal level, I usually give something, well, depends. I usually give something to people I come across asking for money on the street, usually a pound, but it's, well, it's become, if I'm in Swansea, I usually do that because there aren't very many in Swansea where I live, but if I'm in Birmingham or Manchester or Liverpool, it's virtually impossible to do that because you very quickly run out of money. But when I do this, it costs me nothing in time and energy and only a relatively small amount of money. And it doesn't impinge on the time and energy I have for engaging in work for socialism or in any financial contribution to that. However, there are a couple of things I do which I think it's fair to say probably do impinge on time and energy I might otherwise give to socialism. The first is a relatively recent thing, which I'll just say a little bit about, which I came to by a series of chance events. I won't go into detail about these events, but they led to my supporting an asylum seeker in efforts to gain him legal status in this country. That support has meant, among other things for me anyway, a court appearance, helping to draft three different lengthy applications for him for leave to remain. They all failed. And also my accompanying him regularly once a month to the nearest immigration office to sign on and hope he won't be picked up there by Home Office officials and taken to Brooke House in Gatwick with a view to deportation. That did happen to him once before, by the way. He wasn't deported. We managed to get him out in the end, but it could happen to him again at any time of day or night. This young man is from an African country where he escaped from a hostile situation in which his parents were killed. He's now been here for 12 years, since the age of 16, with no entitlement to benefits or work or status or anything else. And that's because he's got no definitive evidence of the story he tells. And as I say, he risks being sent back to any time to the country where he was traumatised and where he's got no connections anymore and indeed fears his life would be in danger. Now, I won't go into this any more here, but to try and tie it to the subject of this session, in supporting this young man, I've been involved in various activities, putting together petitions, appealing to local MPs to provide letters of support and recognition, which, to their credit, they have provided. So a fair amount of time and energy is spent on this, but again, it's stuff I see as being of an essentially personal nature and which I would argue doesn't impinge on commitment to socialism or the socialist idea. It doesn't distort my focus, I hope. It doesn't make me a reformist, I don't think, either. And above all, it doesn't involve the party in reformist activity. I'm aware, of course, that it's not a socialist activity as such either, nor do I have any illusions that whatever the ultimate outcome, it will do anything at all to solve the problem of refugees that capitalism throws up. But I do think that doing this kind of thing can perhaps be considered good preparation for the real Team Human society which we advocate, that is, a socialist society. Of course, it's also true that I get something out of it on a personal level, so that, in a sense, it shouldn't just be considered as altruistic. Another thing I also get something out of that isn't directly to do with socialism is trade union activity. The party's position on trade unions has at various times in its history been a matter of contention among its members. I mean, the party's position is that trade unionism isn't reformism because it's not about appealing to governments or political parties to somehow improve capitalism in the interests of workers. Rather, it's about the battle around division of surplus value between the working class and the capitalist class. So unions are essentially defence mechanisms against the encroachments of capital and also offer the chance of some real, if small, improvement in conditions of life for workers within the framework of the capitalist system. But not all members have always been favourable to that. But I won't rehearse the arguments about this now. but it's a fact that while some socialists have cast doubt on participation in union activity, many people in socialist party history have been keen trade unionists, and I'm one of these. I've been active in my own trade union for well over 20 years, and I've spent a lot of time and energy in that activity. Most of this has been in one way or another associated with challenging the employer precisely on those surplus value issues like pay, working hours, productivity and pensions. But some of it, and in some ways the parts I found most satisfying on a personal level, are those associated with the problems of individual union members, things that are normally called personal cases. Often these do at bottom involve division of surplus value issues of the kind I've just mentioned, but they also sometimes at least involve other more intensely personal matters such as bullying, discrimination, disability, disputes between co-workers, etc. And I spend quite a lot of time on these, and I do that willingly precisely because I think they involve cooperation, empathy, reconciliation, if you can achieve it, all of which, I would argue, would be fundamental to life and organisation in a socialist society. And since I was talking earlier about signing or not signing petitions, my union recently launched a petition for one of its members to be reinstated after he was sacked by his employer for writing with a pen on a Prevent Anti-Terrorism poster the word racist. And I had no hesitation at all in signing that petition. Right, a couple of closing reflections. Firstly, I think it's worth considering the extent to which there's scope for socialists, despite the constraints of capitalism, to participate in collective activity and to live our lives with what I might call a socialist morality and in as socially cohesive a way as possible. In this context, there may sometimes be a fine line between active everyday association and empathy with our fellow humans to try and make life more communal and more livable, and becoming involved in the political activity that non-socialists engage in, which may be well-intentioned but can't possibly tackle the root causes of the problems of life under capitalism. That kind of activity can only in the end, in fact, be a distraction from the spread of socialist ideas. Secondly, a bit more critically maybe, there is, I think, scope for the Socialist Party collectively to practice what we might call socialist ideals more extensively than we do at present in our organisation. Certain things we obviously can't do, like, say, give the socialist standard away free. It's something we're often taunted with. If you're selling the socialist standard on the street or something, people often come up to you and say, you want a moneyless society, but you're asking for money for your magazine. That's a contradiction. Why are you doing that? Well, it's fairly obvious why we're doing that, but certain things we can't do, but certain things we can. So, for example, I think we can run the organisation. Well, we do run the organisation as democratically as possible with open access to all our meetings and deliberations. But I also think that when opportunities arise for us to practice socialist values on what I might call a more intimate level, it's something we should do but don't always do. For example, by trying to practice restorative justice or something similar, if and when a member does something that's manifestly detrimental to the party's interests. And that's definitely something we haven't always done. What we've tended to do is to condemn members who've acted in a way that's obviously detrimental to the party, rather than try to understand them and achieve reconciliation and hopefully agreement. In this connection, there's also the current issue in the party about the use of Amazon Advantage. I know some people feel very strongly about this. This is about the buying and selling practices we have to engage in capitalism and with regard to this particular issue. Is it right for us to engage with some of the capitalist enterprises we know practice the very worst forms of exploitation? Perhaps these are things we could talk about in the discussion period. I'll finish by referring to a book published a few years ago called Role Modelling Socialist Behaviour. It may be for sale there at the back, I'm not sure. Role Modelling Socialist Behaviour, The Life and Letters of Isaac Rabb, put together by his granddaughter, Carla Doris Rabb. Some of you may know or have this book. It was produced by our companion party in the United States, and it's about one of the most indefatigable members of the World Socialist Party of the United States over many decades, Isaac Rabb. Well worth reading, and its title, Role Modelling Socialist Behaviour, is definitely relevant to what I've been talking about today. That is, how individual socialists and the Socialist Party might try to mirror in their day-to-day activities, in so much that it's possible to do that in the world of capitalism, the kind of behaviour which we hope would typify relations in a socialist world. Thank you very much.
Right, thanks very much to Howard for a scintillating talk with plenty of food for thought.